Welcome to Awaken Calls. Every Saturday, we host conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life. Speakers whose personal journeys awaken and inspire our innate spirit of service. Thank you for coming together to plant seeds for a more compassionate society.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone. My name is Arye, and I'll be your host today for our weekly Awaken Call. Welcome, and thank you for joining us. The purpose of these calls is to share stories and tell stories, stories that help plant seeds for a more compassionate society while fostering our own inner transformation. We do this by holding collective conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life who inspire us through their actions to live in a more service-oriented way. And behind each of these calls is an entire team of service-based volunteers whose invisible work allows us to hold this space. Today, our guest speaker is none other than Scott Elias, and someone who really embodies today's theme of designing companies that are loved. Thanks again for joining today's call. Let's start with a moment of silence to anchor ourselves. Welcome again to our weekly Awaken Call. Today, in conversation with Scott Elias, here's how the call works. In a few minutes, our moderator, Rahul Brown, will engage in a deep dialogue with our speaker. And by the top of the hour, we'll roll into Q&A and Circle of Sharing, where we invite all your reflections and questions. I've opened up the queue, so at any point, you can hit star 6 on your phone, and you'll be prompted when it's your turn to speak. You can also email us at ask@servicebase.org. Our guest this week is a serial entrepreneur and visionary, passionate about the role in business in making a better world. He believes that although business has long been stuck among the most powerful, agents for man's progress, but business thinking has been stuck in an increasingly obsolete mechanistic view of the world. How can business make the leap into the world as it actually is now, to a networked, interconnected, interdependent world, to foster mutually rewarding relationships? What is the new way to grow sustainable, profitable companies? We have the pleasure today of a remarkable moderator, Rahul Brown, who is uniquely suited to be involved in this conversation. To give you some context, Rahul in his career is very much involved in business innovation and how business can contribute to a better world. His current role is with SMART.org, helping new companies turn their research and development into innovation and business growth. Prior to SMART.org, Rahul held executive positions with Infinote and with Blue Earth Energy Management Services. He has a BA in economics from UCLA. Rahul is also one of the early members of the service space community, where he's been a volunteer and a respected leader for 14 years, since 2003. Rahul, thanks so much for joining us, and I'll turn it over to you to kick off the conversation.
Thank you so much, Arye, for that warm introduction. And Scott, thank you for making time to be here with us today. It's really remarkable, and I'm so delighted to begin this conversation with you.
I'm honored to be here. Thank you. Thank you for the invitation.
Scott, you're a pioneer in the use of music in creating these unique bonds within companies. And I think that your musical gifts were probably catalyzed with this early experience of losing your hearing in your childhood, in kindergarten, and losing 80% of your hearing. which was then surgically restored a few years later. I'm curious about understanding how you actually experience music today, because I get the sense that you feel it at a deeper level than most of us. So very curious about how you process that.
I want to first say that I wasn't aware of the impact of the loss of my hearing on my life and the way that I experienced the world for many years. I just accepted it as part of my life's experience. And I think in terms of music, part of it is that I hear music, but I hear sound in the silence. And a lot of, it's not uncommon, a lot of musicians will tell you that the power of the sound is really shaped by the silence. And I think in that regard,
Scott, I'm having a little bit of trouble hearing you.
Hearing me? Okay, so yeah. I said I think that for me, it's not so much just hearing the sound or music, it's very much a matter of hearing the sound of silence. And in that, that also connects me to when someone says something to me, I seem to, for the good, and also being quite honest, for my detriment and sometimes others that I work with, I feel things at a very deep level. And it was part of my road to understanding the world around me when I was deaf.
So are you saying that the loss of hearing aided that deep feeling, or was it perhaps a gift that you had, you know, just being maybe a highly sensitive person, which then had this added dimension of musical awareness as a result of the loss of your hearing?
You know, it's hard for me to know. It's a chicken and egg situation, but I don't really see myself as someone who's really extraordinary or a remarkable visionary. I think that I have been connected from the time that I lost my hearing. I believe that I was connected to the world in a different way, and that my connection wasn't just an awareness of the physical, but that I was equally connected to the world, the emotional sensitivities or people's yearnings and their, in a sense, experiencing people's desires or their longings or their dreams as hungers. And also, my intuitive awareness was heightened, I think, from that experience. Now, whether or not we're talking about that I had some sensitivity before, I think that it's hard for me to know, but it certainly gave me what I afterwards almost thought of as superpowers. And they were superpowers for hearing, but also for an awareness of how other people felt.
Right. At what point did you sort of become aware that you kind of had these superpowers?
Well, the physical part I was aware of early on, and I used to play these parlor games where I could hear what people were saying tables away from me or a distance away from me and be able to repeat back what was being said through a combination of hearing things, or it's not uncommon for young people who have lost their hearing, and that's more frequent than we would imagine, at least it was when I was growing up, because if you had adenoid problems and you lost your hearing, you learned to lip read. What I didn't realize until probably about 15 years ago was understanding the emotional connection that I had. And that showed up in my work, where I was really interested in what it is that we were doing and how music was moving people.
Mm-hmm. So there was definitely it sounds like an early awareness of just this capability around heightened hearing and this deep visceral feeling that you would have in terms of people's longings and their relationships. How did you first start thinking about applying those gifts in the early part of your career? What led to kind of you making the first decision on sort of what to do with those unique gifts?
Well, before my experience with work, what happened was I had a grandfather that I was very close with. And we used to share stories together, and the stories were spiritual. And my first connection was that I had a deep connection with the religion that I was born into, which was the Jewish faith. When I was not young, when I was 14, my grandfather contracted cancer, and I was very close to him, and we would spend time together through that. And I just felt when I was 15 that I needed to do something, that if I died, I would have given nothing back to the world that had given me life. And so I went to work on a reservation in Montana, the Northern Cheyenne Reservation. And I left feeling pain because my grandfather was in and out of the hospital at that point. And when I came in, back from the reservation, I was wearing a cowboy hat and a Native American bolo. And I walked in, he gave me a big smile, and that was the last recognition that he had of any people. And he passed away that evening. So for me, that was a powerful experience. And I continued with my Jewish faith until I read Siddhartha and the Hess book. And at that point, I was really no longer able to put the pieces back together. And so in college, what I studied in someone that I looked up to was Ralph Nader, and I was really interested in how one could, through economic incentives and legal constraints, get corporations to act in ways that at that time we called socially responsible. So I studied economics and sociology and political science. I worked in Washington, D.C. as a congressional intern and speechwriter. So when I went into business, I wasn't really thinking about this in that way.
Hmm. That's so rich. Thank you for sharing that deep story. I can see how your grandfather and his passing would certainly have a large impact in your life.
Yes.
Before we get into the theory around your work and the aspects of what you've done in business, I wanted to touch a little bit more on what you shared around how reading Siddhartha kind of shook your worldview. What was it about that book that changed things for you?
Well, I think I grew up as a person in a household and a family where no one had gone to college. And so we had very limited means. I was fortunate to be able to go to college. I went to Northwestern, and I was deeply interested in how it is that I might be able to serve. But what struck me about that book was his journey from wealth and then renunciation to involvement in a corporeal world, a world of materialism, and finally his awakening that he's a journeyman, that he will take people from one side to another of the river. And in a sense, that's the way that I look at myself, that I believe that there's a chasm, and the chasm is layered, but in one sense, the chasm is from success to significance. In another sense, the chasm is from consumers and consuming to seeing people and recognizing that everyone has gifts. And so when I think about it, I think I'm here to help people make that journey across the river and to get to the other side where they see their uniqueness and they're able to embrace their own original medicine. And perhaps that's the work of not business, but commerce.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about what you see as the difference between business and commerce.
Well, just simply put, I'll say that business, as I see it, is transactional. It focuses on consumers. It focuses on revenue, on frequency, on demand. It looks at people as the way that we had studied in economics, where people are self-optimizing, consuming machines, and that the market is rational because when you get enough people deciding together, they're going to, because they're optimizing, their situation, the market will behave rationally. So that whole part, especially the rational part, never sat well with me. Nor did I really feel comfortable with this whole idea of, the consuming machine. And what we've seen now in so many different ways, whether it's the science now around compassion. My wife is a therapist, and she does work with people in trauma, and there's science of compassion, or we're looking at behavioral economics, or we're looking at things like give and take. We recognize that competition is powerful as a force to move us forward, but I see commerce as something where it recognizes that it has another root. The root is community, it's communication, it's communion with yourself and others. And in that sense, we see that consumer as, we see them as people. And that it's, I think the objective there is how to help them move forward to understand what their hungers are. And we sort of frame seven hungers.
That's truly remarkable for business to see people, I guess, in their fullness, in their wholeness, rather than as simply consumers. I'm very curious about when you first realized that kind of business was stuck in this outmoded way of being, and when you did realize it, what were your first attempts around doing something to change it?
Well, as I said, I don't see myself as remarkable, because I think that we've had a lot of unsatisfying endings. But I guess my first work in my own company was really around telling stories and saying that music had a very different role than traditional storytelling. So oftentimes within the context of a story, you can make up the story. But I think within music, it speaks to us on a level that we understand, and we know when there is when music diverges from the authentic story. And the first hunger that we look at is a hunger for recognition, for being seen. And all the recognition that we get, all the awards and all the money and all the power, we don't see or don't feel that we're being recognized, because that's not the recognition that we're talking about. The recognition that I'm speaking about, that first hunger, is around authenticity. And so within music, what I found was when we would tell stories, so we did the music for the trailer for Alien and Altered States and Blade Runner and Gandhi and Ghostbusters. With each of those, it was making sure that you understood the authentic story and that you were able to give voice to that. And so for me, that was really the earliest part of an awareness that music had a very different role and a profound role.
Sure. You've obviously been responsible for launching, growing, or repositioning almost 40% of the biggest brands in the world and won so many awards for these, including Emmys and hundreds of Clios and London International Awards. But I'm curious about the early days of your work when you were crafting music in this sort of new way. Was it something that other people understood, or did they just feel like, you know, you were perhaps, you know, maybe, I mean, was it necessarily a recognition around this bond building or this affinity
No.
that was occurring as
No.
a result of music? Okay.
I think you have your finger on the pulse of something that's much larger, and that is, no, they didn't have that. And I'm not sure that if they did, that they would have felt more comfortable. I think that there were enough people that were uncomfortable with the approach that we were taking, and that this is continued to be a journey. We did the original logo for Apple Computer and work with Jay Shiat, the Greenbergs, and Steve Jobs. And we also worked on the Think Different campaign, doing all the music for that. And in both of those, we're dealing with a situation where, you know, people would be very, even those people would be very uncomfortable with the kind of conversation that we're having. And yet I think if it were off the record in more intimate environments, which is why I believe that it's important to break bread with people and to recognize them as people, that you open yourself to truths that are hard to share often in a boardroom.
Mm.
And within that, one example, we were working with Nike on something, and we had been called in by a group called the Advanced Concept Team. So they have three different pillars within the organization at that point. And this is probably about 10 years ago. And so the pillars were apparel, gear, and footwear. And we were suggesting to them, they were in a period of sort of stasis, and they were looking for other ways to grow beyond acquisition. And we suggested that instead of thinking about a product-oriented focus, that they might want to think about how it is that they could enhance or grow the relationship that they had with their, you know, with the people that they called clients. And we thought that the fourth pillar for them might be training, so that they would have a more intimate relationship with the people who are actually using their, in that case, it would be software and coaching and whatnot. And they weren't, it just never got off the ground. But they thanked us for our role. And instead, what happened was we met a fellow who was on that team and who was really frustrated because he had a concept and no one within the organization that was high up, and he reported directly into the president and to this team. And it was this idea for a yellow bracelet called Livestrong. And so he and I, we were out to dinner with a group of people, and he probably had, you know, a few drinks, and he was like, I want to talk to you about something at the bar. I haven't had any traction on it. And so I would be there with him. I said, Scott, I think that's a great idea. And it was, what if yellow was the color of strength, the color of, and it, if it was a bracelet. And in any case, the first question was, what if Nike could own the color yellow? And eventually, Nike moved away from it. They took their logo off of it, and they just had Livestrong on the bracelets. But the initial run had the Nike logo on it. So I was there helping him, I think, on both a personal level, coaching, but also helping him with what I think was his vision and how to get that across the finish line. We helped delivering music to him to sell it in. And, you know, I think that was one case in which it was successful, but also seeing beyond the consumer and recognizing it's really the power of the relationship, not the object.
I see. It sounds like in this particular case, the process for helping them find this sort of unique purpose came through the route of an individual who was sort of reaching out and looking to be heard for a kind of divergent idea. I'm curious about whether there is a sort of formalized process that you're able to take companies through for finding their unique purpose. And if you can just share a little bit more about that, there is.
So imagine that you have two lines that cross in the center and form an X. And then through those lines, there is another line that runs east-west. So what we do is the line on, let's look at everything above the line. That's what we call the original medicine. So on the left-hand side, we help clients with identifying what are the unique skills or gifts that they have. And on the right-hand side, we ask them, what's the one thing that they want to be able to make better? If there is, whether it's a pain or a passion, and then in the center, we look at the why. And the why has purpose and values. So when we do that, we say, okay, look, let's just start with something really simple. What do you see in the world? And it could be that you see a world where, you know, technology is very powerful, and yet in the case of medicine, it was not so long ago, even in the 60s, when 70% of the people in the United States lived within 20 minutes of a family member. And then less than 20 years later, we're looking at a situation where now it's less than 5%. So that's what we see. Then we'll talk about, what do you believe? We believe that if people felt connected and felt closer and they felt that it wasn't just about family, that they could expand that circle of what that they would be healthier because they understood that people, you know, cared. And then the third part that we talk about is, what is it that you want to do about that? And then we bring it back to that X, and we look at, so what is that one thing that you want to do in that upper right-hand quadrant? Now, where the X meets the line, that's what happens in the now, and the now keeps changing. Below the X, we look at the landscape, and we say, what is right now, what's happening within the landscape, and what do we think is possible? And then we talk about how it is that we think we can impact that.
Very interesting. You know, I recall maybe about a decade ago, there was this film that came out around it's called The Corporation, and it was talking about how the way articles of incorporation are currently written, that corporations are only beholden to their stakeholders, their shareholders, for generating returns.
Yes.
And I'm curious about how this reconciles with your idea around businesses finding their unique purpose or their original medicine.
I think it's an important question because it goes back to a question that I think you asked earlier and I didn't answer very well. And the question was more around how is it that companies are not only understanding what's happening, but what their role and their responsibility is, and how do they bring that into the workplace. And there's another book called The End of Shareholder Value, which I think is a remarkably damaging concept when you think that's really where you're going to decide what the value is. I think we need to look at people. We need to recognize that we're no longer playing by mechanistic rules, and the corporation was conceived in another time, and we need to understand that the role of a company, I think, is much greater, and its power is much greater as it serves a different set of needs and issues. If we think not so much starting with what if companies were designed for love, but if we ask the question, if the purpose of law is justice and say the purpose of medicine is health, what's the purpose of business or commerce? And I think the way that I would answer that is it's really about the evolution of people, of society, and the planet. Now, when we look at the world in a mechanistic way, it's basically, you know, binary. And I think much of the challenge that we have as a society today is, whether it's political or it's in business, is that we're looking at this win-loss column rather than understanding that we all do better when we all do better. And it's not about who are picking the winners or the losers. It's how do we, as, you know, sort of the Hans Rosling from TED and his living statistics showed, how as a world we're doing better together. I think the mechanistic and the corporate definitions are deeply troubling, and that they're always going to deliver us suboptimal outcomes.
Sure. Yeah, and we certainly see that occurring in the world today. Scott, a number of people have mentioned that your audio is low, so I'm wondering if there's you can hold the microphone closer as we...
Yeah, I can hold the phone, and then I can't hear you, so just give me a moment when you're asking a question. So go ahead.
Sure. So, you know, it seems to me that there clearly are these sort of divergent impulses within corporations themselves, where according to the legal framework and the charter, there is only that responsibility for a return, and yet as individuals, none of us can truly authentically feel, or very few of us, I should say, can authentically feel that would be the purpose of our work and the purpose of our time on this planet, given that it's finite. So I'm really curious about how you sort of walk, you know, given that these two sort of points on the spectrum exist, how do you use marketing in a way that actually raises awareness and affinity for a product versus kind of manipulating them into wanting or feeling something they wouldn't otherwise feel, to sell products in a way that enhances the very base idea that's sort of written into corporate charters around maximizing shareholder return?
I just want to say, I don't think that maximizing shareholder return is done through a target put and sell. Target Push and Sell was the game that we started playing around World War II when this couple came together and they saw fire in one another's eyes. And one of the individuals, they both had the same first name, one of the individuals was mass production and the other one was mass communications. When they fell in love, they had three children. You know, I say advertising, PR, and then later research. We are still playing because of that mechanistic mindset. And what's woven into that mechanistic mindset is fear. It's fear around other people, fear of a lack of enoughness. And that fear is, I think, what sort of pushes us to believe that the way to maximize shareholder value is through target push and sell. But what's a more enduring and sustainable approach to growth and profitability than, I think, growth that grows people? And if one earns a reasonable return on that, you know, why isn't that perhaps the best way to grow your business and also the most sustainable? Because lots of businesses now look at the issue around lifetime customer value. And so my approach in terms of answering your original question is that for me, marketing is about marketing what is truly there, marketing what I think the authentic value is based on a set of beliefs that we've, you know, understood to be what they're actually living within the organization. And that's another problem. It's marketing often is about how do we sell more stuff rather than what do we believe, what do we value. And then when the person has an experience with the organization, is that experience going to align with the expectation that we've set? And how, again, do we develop that as a relationship rather than focusing on the product?
You were touching on these seven deep hungers that people experience and sort of alluding to the idea that companies perhaps have an opportunity to sort of fill more hungers. Can you share more about what those hungers are?
Well, yes. Let me just say that the way that I think of it is that within products and relationships, what we really need to do is we need to recognize that there's a functional dimension, which includes both the tangible or physical needs, and then there's the informational, which might include search, wayfinding, the informational or knowledge needs. Those two, physical and informational, I put under the rubric of the functional. Then there's the relational dimension, which talks about other hungers, and those are emotional, they're psychic, they are soulful, family, and communal. But to be specific, the way that we look at it is a little bit different. We're looking at saying the first hunger is for recognition. Then we're saying meaning, belonging, freedom, fulfillment, love, and transcendence. So and each one is fed by a different or nourished by a different food. So the hunger for meaning is fed by a clarity of purpose. The hunger for recognition is fed by authenticity. The hunger for belonging is fed through acceptance and resonance and saluting that or seeing that holiness within that other. The freedom is fed with agency, fulfillment with joy, love with compassion, and transcendence with love.
That's beautiful. And so when you are crafting sort of a message, or let's say when you're designing a commercial for one of these large brands, are you consciously doing something to kind of build in some kind of a hint or some kind of a nugget for each of those seven hungers in that message?
The first thing is that what interests me is it really there within both the product and the organization? How is it going to be delivered? So one group of students that I'm working with are students that are getting a master's degree in hospitality management, but also hospitality innovation. So we're able to craft different approaches to products or product delivery, and likewise also working with students in the area of culinary management and innovation. Then in the U.S., I'm working with graduate students who are interested in how they might commercialize innovation, as well as students who are working in branding and integrated communications. So the first thing that we're doing, whether it's with students or clients, is asking them, let's look at the product, let's look at the company, and how are we addressing these three areas, or the functional and then the relational. And if we're not addressing the relational, then we feel that we have a situation where we could do more. What do we need to do? How do we need to think about it so we can do more? In a sense, then, we're looking at, you know, how are we addressing our so-called citizen clients?
Tell me more about that.
Yes, we are. We are looking at that, but we're looking at it more broadly, because I think that when we think about marketing as what's the tagline, or what does the ad look like, or what is the campaign, or what is the social media, you know, do we really want social media, or do we want meaningful relationships? Do we want relationships that are mutually rewarding? Are we finding value from what's meaningful, or are we looking at what is expensive and therefore giving that the value and then trying to find meaning there?
Hi, this is Arye, and thanks to the two of you, I'm finding that this is really unfolding for me through your dialogue, and I hope for others listening too. I just want to remind everyone listening that if you've got a question or a comment for Scott and you're on the phone, you can dial *6 and you'll be in our queue. And otherwise, you can ask a question at ask@servicespace.org. And so we'll be taking questions around the top of the hour.
Thanks so much for that, Arye. Scott, one of the things you talk about is sort of transparency and authenticity's role in kind of creating these mutually enriching and mutually rewarding relationships. I'm curious about whether a large brand can truly embody this authenticity and transparency, or do they look at each of their sort of marketing messages or approaches as simply one channel for a specific demographic? Could you share a little bit more about kind of how those big brands tend to think about this?
I think most big brands are questioning what is working and what is not. I would say that in the past, when we're talking to bigger brands, they're not interested in the mechanistic versus the network. They're not interested in a bigger look, see at what it is that they're doing. They are still stuck in a competitive mindset that says, yes, we need to get our market share. Nike will say that, I won't say the percentage, but if they go into a market, they think that they should get a minimum of this X percentage. So that's the way that they're thinking. They're seeing competition in a very simple way. Now, I think this gives an opportunity for many smaller companies or startup brands to recognize that cooperation and collaboration and niches are all part of the network model, and that they're actually competitive strategies. Cooperation and collaboration are competitive strategies. It's not just that we have to sharpen elbows. Now, there are companies who are asking these questions and who are beginning to say, you know, we want what works, and maybe this is another approach that we might consider. And I think there are big companies that are asking that, you know, those kinds of questions. One that I work with was Whole Foods, and I know, you know, John Mackey is big on this conscious capitalism, and they are asking those questions. And I think there's a number of bigger brands that are asking and are thinking about how is it that we take these kinds of issues, not just in our marketing, but that we understand that it's not just about marketing, it's about living it. So if I talk about that original medicine, I think that original medicine, there's something where those companies are really alive when they are taking that original medicine, which I just refer to with them as it, in the boardrooms, and I say, it's a matter of get it, got it, live it. And how do we live it? Mm-hmm. And there aren't as many, but there are many more smaller firms that are doing that. And seeing that as a way to develop a competitive advantage against, you know, Goliath.
Sure. Can you talk a little bit more about the difference between when you're working with a giant company and when you're working with sort of a small company that's just getting started? Did the giants get big by kind of being clear around their purpose from the beginning? What is the point along the growth of a small company where they sort of face pressure to let go of that intrinsic purpose if in fact they were clear of it from the get-go?
Well, I think how you define that purpose, if you define it in a way that is you know, clear and powerful enough, then what you actually deliver in terms of your services or the products, your offerings, may change even though you still have a clarity of purpose. I think it's very hard for many firms to start with a clarity of purpose and retain that. For instance, one firm that I'm working with now, they've been around a little bit less than a year. They are a group of people who were in the music business as I was, and they saw that music has less and less value or perceived value in the marketplace. It generates less revenue. And yet they said, you know, the relationship that these artists have with their audience, like an Ed Sheeran, regardless of what we think about the music, there's tremendous resonance for that artist. And so what they do is they bank artist audiences, and then they loan those banks to brands, and they split the revenue with the artists. So their idea was, look, nothing good has really been happening in the music industry as far as artists are concerned. What if we could monetize artist audiences, and we could share that with the artist? And their thought was they wanted to do something really powerful for artists. Now, they're in the process of taking this from artists and saying, okay, just people in the music industry, that there are many influencers or there are many audiences that they could identify, that they could bank, and that they could share that revenue with that artist. So it would significantly change the business and financial model for that industry. And in a sense, their purpose doesn't change, it expands a bit, but their objective, which was to recognize that how can we value creativity and find a way to share those audiences with a brand, but protect the identity of the audience. And all the tests that they've been developing have been phenomenal. Does that answer your question?
A little bit. I'm just sort of I'm sort of curious around, you know, like I get the sense that it's perhaps more difficult for a public company to embody a sense of purpose because of their fiduciary responsibilities. Or the fiduciary responsibilities of the board and the executives. So, I mean, is that the case, or you know, is it easier for a small private company to really own and authentically own a sense of intrinsic purpose than sort of a large company?
Well, one would say, you know, yes, and yet you get people. Whether it's looking at Starbucks and Starbucks' interest in now helping immigrants around the world with jobs and opportunity, or Google, which has now a lot of their marketing, they're working with an organization up in Portland. Swift has been around empowering women engineers, or looking at Whole Foods. I think in some way when you have a visionary CEO and someone who, has helped start the company and grow the company, I think it's easier in that case to do it. When it becomes a company that, and look, I think in a way Whole Foods went through this where they brought in another CEO. You had co-CEOs there. And their vision was around size. It was like we're going to have 1,000 stores. And that is – it's really hard to motivate people to get them up in the morning with saying, oh, we're going to be 1,000 stores. Whereas if you feel that you're doing something, I think, frankly, we've really reached the end of the power curve for what we can do with incenting employees with money alone or with titles or whatever. And I think we have to get people to contribute because they feel that it fits with their vision of the world and their view of what it is that people and society really needs. There's an area of branding called cultural branding, and Apple would be, say, a good example of that. In another era, you could say Nike and perhaps Under Armour. But the idea is that it starts with understanding some fundamental conflict in society. The brand creates, recognizes that, meets people where they are and says, I see your pain with Nike. It was, I see that you have limited opportunities for other brands. The only one out there at that point was Big Blue. And we feel your pain. We see that you want to make a difference in the world and that it's your creativity and the way that you see that can make the difference. You create a new narrative, a new mythology. And then the third piece is you have to deliver from a marketing standpoint. You have to deliver products, but you have to deliver a service experience at retail or online that supports that.
Sure. But, you know, this idea around the business's intrinsic purpose and their original medicine isn't something that is really taught in business schools or really rewarded necessarily in
right.
in corporations. Why is that?
Well, I think that there are, three very significant challenges. The first is looking at, consumers and saying, okay, that's the way that we see the world. And, you know, the second part of it is the way that we look at competition, you know, business and market competition rather than what's the purpose of business is, you know, evolution of people. And the other is that I think the fundamental, most fundamental challenge, though, is the way that we look at people as consumers. And the second thing is that we're focused on success in a transactional model. And I think that goes back to World War II, to a target push and sell when mass communications and, you know, mass production came together. And so, I mean, I think it would be really interesting to take a look at marketing without advertising or without, in a sense, social media. What would that look like?
What would it look like?
Well, I think it would focus more on relationships, on working on mutually rewarding working relationships, and it would look at commerce and its purpose as to help people in their own lives with identifying what their original medicine, their it is, and how you can help them move forward, them and their loved ones, and the, you know, the people and communities and animals and nature as they see it, that they care about.
Oh, Scott, you're trailing off.
Okay. So it's how do they help people find their it, their original medicine, and not just theirs, but their loved ones and the people that they care about and the community and the animals and planet. So I'm not a big believer that the way that we think about marketing is on target.
Mm-hmm.
So,
wonderful.
All right. Well, Let's continue, and we have a few questions that people have sent in, and we can get started with some of them. Thank you, Scott, and thank you, Raul, for the journey through this topic. I want to remind everyone again, if you'd like to join the conversation and you're on the phone, it's *6. If you're at a computer or portable device, it's ask@servicespace.org. So here's a comment from Doug in Portland, Maine. And Doug says, Scott, thank you for your work and wise sharing today. What is the place of vulnerability in creating a workplace culture that inspires, nurtures, and grows personal and organizational integrity?
I'm not sure that I fully grasp that question, but...
Yeah, he's asking, what is the role of vulnerability in all...
Oh, vulnerability. What is the role? I think it's... I sort of think, in a sense, it's recognizing that we each have gifts, and sometimes we look at the world through that lens, and we have a hard time we may be judging other people through the lens of our own gifts, recognizing that whatever power we have and whatever in the form of those gifts, recognizing that we have to be willing to understand that we can't look at other people through that lens and evaluate them. We have to, I think, humility, vulnerability is, it has to be sort of the fulcrum and the starting point for that, for a workplace that is productive and that honors people. And
I know that, you know, my own experience in business, and I think for a lot of us, it's very it feels very risky to make oneself vulnerable in the workplace, right? If I admit
yes
to some kind of a problem or some kind of a weakness, you know, maybe that will be damaging to me in the workplace. Have you ever come into a situation where the management of that, you know, of that department or that company actually does something to say it's okay to be vulnerable here.
I think there are many more companies now that are saying that it's important to be vulnerable. There's a very large company that I was working with, and the people that – so I was working with a small company. They sold to a Fortune 500. They made one of the people the global VP of marketing, and I was working with him and his first lieutenant, who is creative director. In any case, they were putting great points up on the board. Revenue was up, and yet they had they were having increasing challenges between themselves and their entire department that had 300 people in it. And no matter what it is that they had done from a metrics side, the company was having a harder and harder time with them because they were driving their vision through the organization. And we brought someone else in, and we worked together to reframe what needed to happen with more awareness of both the culture and needing to bring other people into this process and honor, you know, honor them, not just this hard-driving ethic. But we actually, I think part of the reason that it may have worked was because we had worked with these two guys when they had a small company doing $500,000 a year, and their company ended up doing $3 million a year in a period of 2 years after that, and they sold to this bigger company. And so we had experience with them on a personal level that, you know, we could go in there and say, hey, look, guys, you're doing all the stuff that a Fortune 500 wants, but this company has another dimension, and their culture says the way that you're doing it is not going to work here.
Yeah. Yeah, so you were able to give them that feedback, and they were able to hear.
Yes. And they were able to hear it because we had a relationship where they knew that there was honesty and there was mutual respect.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of it, is if you don't have that, it's really – you guys talk about this again and again in your organization, I think, the whole importance of trust.
Mm-hmm.
And how can you have trust unless you have transparency and you have authenticity?
Yep, makes sense. We have a caller in the queue, so you are on.
Hi, everyone. Hi, Scott. Thank you so much. This has been such a fascinating conversation, and I really appreciate the insights that you've given so far. I myself work in marketing communications.
Who is this? What is your name, and where are you calling
from? Oh, hi. Yeah, my name is Seema. I'm calling from the Bay Area.
Hi, Seema.
Hi. So Scott, I'm really intrigued by this idea of how to have marketing without advertising or social media. And how do you think we could start making that shift? Because I feel like business and a lot of companies are still rooted in that target push sell paradigm and that fear-based paradigm and the, you know, having a, you know, building revenue and focusing on their, you know, annual profits, all of that. So what do you think are some ways to start creating that shift?
I wish I had a really good answer for you. I think that it depends very much in the organization. When I think about it, I just say, look, there are these three forces that are changing the nature of our world. And the first force is that we're moving from consumers to citizens. I mean, that's the nature of social media, where people are voting. Everybody wants to get a good rating on Amazon or whatever, or share it on Instagram. The second for me is this notion of transaction. It's everything that I see is in relationship. And the way that I think about that is that we've moved from the mechanistic into the network world. And there are so many different ways that we connect or that the network connects. And it leads me to say, okay, well, it's no longer the rules that we make in a world of machines and where the world has to run like a clock, or that you know that someone is challenged when they say, this is broken, let's fix it. Imagine going into a therapist or into any kind of setting like that and saying, can you fix me? I'm broken. So I think in a network world, we have another opportunity, and that is we have the opportunity to connect with people in a way that can be much deeper. So it's not about connectivity in terms of, oh, can I get any kind of media, or can I do search, or can I connect with the internet, but what does it take for me to connect with that person on a deeper level and understand that nature or the landscape always sets the rules? Dynamic balance, resilience, strength in a different way, in the way that a tree can bow in the wind. The only thing that I can say, if I would, in one word, is conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Just asking questions.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Seema. Scott, following up on your response, I'm wondering how you scale that conversation. It's easy to scale transactions on social media, right? You can do lots of them. But
right.
How do you, if you're running a large business and you're saying, well, do it via relations, and, you know, that takes time. It takes one-on-one commitment. How does a company scale that? Or is that the wrong question?
No, I think it is a good question. I think it's an important question. How does one scale but any kind of organization? However, at the same time, just in the way that it seems your community values small actions, if we look at network systems, it's often small actions that have very large consequences. There are, you know, many companies in the hospitality industry that have worked with scaling it. Two that are probably most best known are the Four Seasons and Ritz-Carlton, where they share, and they do it through sharing stories. But when Apple started the retail, what they did is they benchmarked against the Four Seasons. They asked who provides the best service and how do we frame or think about service so that people are not paid by how much they sell. And there's they use the acronym Apple, like, you know, approach for how it is that they get people within their retail to deal with someone that is coming through the door. Then they give you three different ways that you can move through that retail experience. One, you could check out by yourself for certain size or dollar products. Then you can make an appointment or you can meet. So I think there are ways. I think it's a really important question. Can you scale this? But there are ways to scale it.
Hmm. Thank you. Yeah, I'm thinking about my wife used to work for a large healthcare organization, and their way of scaling it was that each time a patient came in to see a doctor or a nurse practitioner or other provider, they might be asked to fill out a form saying how satisfactory was the experience.
Right.
And that feedback was made available to the provider and their supervisor. So it was a way of scaling the corporate value that we want good relationships with our clients.
Well, and that is becoming more and more common. That's what I'm saying. Or, you know, I think about it as there are these three elements. So there's what's the principles, what is the process, and what does the practice look like? A good example of that right now that across a lot of the larger great hospitals, they're doing the same kind of thing. The Cleveland Clinic, if you go onto their website, just take a look at what their the importance that they put on experience design. And I'm sure within your audience there is probably a lot of people that know the work that not just IDEO is doing, but a number of great organizations are doing around experience design, you know, 3.0 and 4.0. 4.0 is looking at societal change on a, you know, broader, obviously broad scale. Going back, 1.0 would be looking at the product. 2.0 would be looking at the organization. 3.0 would be looking beyond the organization, but not to the whole culture. And 4.0 would be looking at, you know, what kind of cultural changes you want to make.
Wow, okay, got a whole scale over there. Okay, we've got a few more questions here that have come in via email. This next one is from Carol Ruth Silver. Carol Ruth Silver was one of our guests previously, and she was previously a supervisor of the City of San Francisco. So her question is, are you a fan of the B Corporation? And then she says, inclusion in the purposes of the corporation of community, environmental, and worker benefits.
A couple of years ago, I was at a conference and I met this gentleman who was the founder of B Corp. I think anything that moves in that direction is a really important step forward. Ultimately, I think nothing is going to change unless we look at people as people and not as consumers and not as targets. If I can't see another human being and I don't understand what that human being's yearnings or hungers are, it's really hard to make any change, whether it's a B Corp. I think it was a year ago, there was a really great book all around how to look at changing the organization and the relationships. And then you probably saw that Zappos changed the internal organization. They called it Holacracy. That was based on this fellow's work from McKinsey. You know, ultimately, there's a lot of things that you can change, but until you see that that individual is a person and that in some way you have something to offer that person and that person has something equally valuable to offer you beyond money. And so what is the nature of the relationship that you have beyond money? The Cleveland Clinic is recognizing that there's a lot more to getting healthy than whatever I can do surgically or whatever medicine that I can give you as well.
It sounds like you've really just articulated kind of the basic DNA underlying all of this.
Yes.
Locked
inside of all of us are millions of years of evolutionary success. What works, but obviously also what doesn't. And I think what I really value and appreciate about what your community is doing is that I think you don't have to be the CEO of Google or Starbucks, that each one of us, the opportunity is me. It's not you, the opportunity is me.
Mm. Beautiful. Okay, let's see. A couple more questions here. Glenda from L.A. wants to know, she says, how might we contact Scott? The contact us link at Living Works is not working.
Oh, that's strange. Okay. Well, I would suggest I'll give you the link. It is SLIS at Living Works. That maybe there's the wrong address. That's,
you know, what we can do is when we send out the thank you email afterwards, Scott, let's make sure we get that right link. Do you want people to contact you by email as well, or is that link the way to go?
No, email is great.
Okay, so we'll make sure we include that. Here's another comment from Vimal in Toronto. And Vimal says, thank you, Scott, for sharing your thoughts. I have recently started a healthcare analytics firm, and I realize that I do not have any clarity of purpose. But in my heart, I know that I want to truly serve my clients. I just don't know how to align my heart's desire with my company's purpose. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that it would require me having a more present conversation about that. But I think that's the work that we all have. And I wanted to lead a venture firm that had, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars and could invest in these kinds of companies. And I wanted to have a firm that could do search where we would be able to bring people in that. And but that isn't where I ended up. And there's a wonderful book called The Soul of Money. And
yes.
She talks about enoughness. And I just recognized that this is where I was, and it was okay if I was investing $50,000 or $100,000 or $10,000, or I was just investing my time. I spent 10 years just working with small companies. Most of them were not able to pay me anything, but I knew that my journey was so much richer. I think that for this gentleman, his heart and his business can definitely be aligned. I don't know what he would feel is the one thing that he wants to change. If I were to say simply, just go through this exercise, if he wanted to do this himself, three questions. First question is, what do you see in the world? What is the pain that you see? The second is, what do you believe can address that? And the third is, what do you aim to do about that? More than that, I think I would need to speak to them.
Beautiful answer. We've got a few comments from some people. This is Michael Amiskua, I think I pronounce it. He said, I make archetypal jewelry out of steel. Mm-hmm. Someone told me it would take a special person to wear it. I responded, dude, we're all special.
Exactly. I agree. Yeah,
sounds like he's on your wavelength.
Yeah, I agree.
Here's a comment from Suzanne Hale, who says, designing companies that are loved means service to me. To be at the service of the clientele, to listen and be influenced by their needs, resources, collaborating with their seasons and cycles, and ultimately being influenced by the customer experience. Having leaders who are service-oriented is a truly wonderful company experience they can demonstrate by example. Thank you for asking these questions.
No, I totally agree with that. The only thing that I would say is one challenge that I see every day with larger companies is because the focus is the transaction or seeing that person as a consumer, what happens is it goes on, the process or this exchange goes on outside of them. And I think the first thing when we talk about service is we have to talk about what is it that we are going to serve with. The notion of original medicine is this idea that on the left side of that top line of the X are what are all the gifts that I have, including my resources? And then what is my why? You know, my purpose. And then that target is, now with all of that, what is the one thing that I really want to do about that? And knowing that where that those lines cross, that's my now, and it keeps changing. And I have to feel, you know, like I'm alive, and that's also the point that I'm meeting that person. That's where I'm meeting that citizen client. And am I serving them? And to me, that's serving them. Am I helping them in their evolutionary journey?
Okay, and then I've got one last comment here. This is from David. He talks about some of the ideas you've talked about realizing we're in a networked, interconnected world. And he says, we better make the leap quickly. The situation is urgent.
Yes, I agree.
What we have to do to our world, we do to ourselves.
Yes.
That's David. Let's see, before I ask my final question, I want to ask you, Rahul, if you have any last quick reflection or comment or question.
Oh, sorry, Ari, I was on mute. I was mostly just struck by, Scott, your presence comes across as a very kind of intuitive, gentle presence, and my perception of the way that boardrooms work is actually very different. So I'm just curious about the contrast, or at least how you're initially received in those worlds, or whether it's even an issue since you just have such a profound reputation. Does your reputation just precede you and kind of let your voice be heard?
I think that's part of it. I don't think that was always the case. And again, I don't think that I'm, extraordinary. There was a lot of bumping up against walls, and a lot of what it is that I tried didn't work. And I've been fortunate to have tremendous level of things that have worked and that the companies have gone on to do extremely well. So I when I go in, I think one thing that they do see is that I have tremendous confidence, and it's a quiet confidence. And I have a different way of seeing things that helps me explain what has happened in a way that they haven't thought of before. So, for instance, Nike did end up going with that fourth pillar. It took them 10 years, but they have the Nike Training Club. And I wish they'd put more energy into that. Talk to them about how is it that they missed Steph Curry. They didn't see it because they had a vision for what an athlete looks like. So I can help them. I have confidence, and I can help them understand things that maybe are challenges that are beyond their, horizon line. But I'm not looking at it as a problem and how I can fix it.
Interesting.
Great. Thank you. So we're getting close to the end of our time for our call. And, Scott, I'm going to ask you the traditional final awaken call question, I think with what I see as a slightly different angle. The question we ask our guests is, how can we, the service-based community, how can we support you and your work? To that, I'm going to say, how can we support the purpose that you've been talking about of changing the world through the individual relationships? And how specifically, I want to add, does this apply to a community such as ours, where there's really isn't any money involved, there's no hierarchy, it's just volunteers connecting with each other around the world? What's the connection here?
I feel as though we're addressing sort of the same issues. It's like we're two sides of the same coin. And your giftivism and your acts of compassion and paying it forward are profound. And I think that what I love about it is that people can start anywhere. And I'm not sure how we can help one another, but I would love to be able to try, because my belief is that the gift that each one of us has, our own uniqueness, our own set of gifts. But it's not enough to have them and to recognize them. We have to commit to them, we have to hone them, and then we have to share them so that we're living that in our daily lives. And I think that involves business, or what I prefer to call commerce. And so maybe it's around talking about these kinds of issues. Maybe it's around asking people what in business that you're working in, where are they getting stuck? What kinds of questions are coming up that are walls that where we need bridges? How can we see people? How can we form the essence of all value is meaning. How can we create, you know, more that is meaningful?
Beautiful. That's a great way for us to close out this conversation. I want to say thank you so much again, Scott
thank
Elias,
you.
For being here with us today and sharing your wisdom and insight and experience. And also thank you so much, Rahul, for being our moderator, and thanks to the whole Service Space team. We're going to take a moment of silence in gratitude for our being together. And then afterwards, I'll unmute us, and we all have the chance to give a shout out of thank you to Scott. So let's take that minute of silence now. So now we're unmuted, and now is our chance to say thanks. Thank you, Scott.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.